All right, welcome. This is Mike Adams here, the founder of Brighteon.com. Excuse my raspy voice today. I'll explain that later. But I've got a great guest joining me today, someone who I first met in studio at the Alex Jones Studios in Austin. It's a U.S. Army surgeon and Green Beret, Doc Pete Chambers, as he goes by, an extraordinary individual that's in this battle for health freedom and really helping to get a lot of things changed for veterans and active duty members of the military and also civilians as well. Dr. Pete Chambers, welcome to the show. It's an honor to have you on, sir.
It's great to hear you, and it was great meeting you the first time. Yes, sir.
Well, you are an extraordinary individual. You've been through a lot yourself. Can you give our viewers, since this is the first time that we've been able to interview you here, can you give our viewers a quick background of what led you to where you are right now?
Sure. I was an 18-year-old kid looking for a job, joined the Army in 1983 under Ronald Reagan. Served 39 years between active guard and reserves, did my last stint with Texas National Guard on the border and the invasion that I call it on our southern border, finished that in May and retired. And along the way, I was an infantryman, a paratrooper, a Green Beret, and a flight surgeon. So I guess you call it a Swiss Army knife.
Wow, I guess so. So did you serve as a surgeon, as you know, on staff?
Well, I never really worked in a hospital. Yeah. You know, when you're a Green Beret doc, they expect you to do the same stuff. So you're jumping out of planes, you're on the X, so to speak, or we call it, you know, being close to the battle. I tended to get a little closer than the commanders liked. However, I always explained that's where the casualties are, sir. And, you know, there's a lot of because I did carry a rifle before and before that job. So they felt comfortable with me being out there, and it's where I needed to be. And
well, brought that guys makes home. Makes good sense. I want to give out your website too. It's drpetechambers.com. So drpetechambers.com. And you've got all your links there where people can find you on Telegram and other places as well. Mm-hmm. And when your most recent deployment was, as you said, with the Texas National Guard, correct? On the border.
Yes, sir.
And that deployment just ended recently, did it not?
For me, it ended probably at the end of the year. You know, December, but I had to continue on to get my retirement. 30th of May is when I officially retired.
Oh, okay.
Out, but yeah, that was quite an event down there.
Yeah, and it's nowhere near over either,
as
you well know, and it's a problem that's being widely ignored. But we're not even going to focus on that problem tonight. Let's talk about vaccines, and I know that you publicly said that you know you were vaccine injured. And you're fighting for vaccine choice in the military. Can you give us a quick briefing of your experience in that area?
Sure, absolutely. That's great. Then we could segue into the fight. When the shots first came out for the military, and then I was put on that mission to Operation Lone Star to be the surgeon, like every other soldier standing in line. This was before VAERS data, before the defense medical epidemiology data that I was a whistleblower on, before all of that. Hey, here's your next shot. You're taking this. And I had just come from Africa. So I was not in the know as far as what was going on worldwide with this thing. We don't get a lot of news in the Sahara. So I show up to Texas and take the shot. You're going to be the task force surgeon. I go down there. And within a few weeks, I started getting some brain fog and the typical things you hear people, vertigo, tinnitus, you know, ringing in the ears. And then somewhere about 2-3 weeks later, some of the soldiers that opted to take it on their own, they didn't have to at the time, had my first case of a soldier that was 27-year-olds with myocarditis. Now, didn't really put it together at that time. It's, you know, hindsight's 20/20 now. But as we started getting more cases and more things like that in this younger population, and I really followed this soldier carefully, we had to pull him out of the military. His heart, you know, became like an 80-year-old with congestive heart failure.
Wow.
So that was concerning. Mandates come along in April or August, I'm sorry, the Department of Defense mandates where we had to take them. And at this point, I've been doing informed consents, following people like, Dr. Tenpenny and Dr. Malone and Dr. McCullough. I was listening to them, but they didn't really have an informed consent for us to give out. They just said, okay, well, just tell them to take it. And I'll tell you an interesting story here in a second, but I'm doing informed consents. and nobody's taking it because essentially I'm at this point going, no, we're not doing this because I've already started to have this problem where, you know, I got vertigo. I can't drive. My job, I went from McAllen, Texas to Presidio, Texas and back and forth. So that's a long ways, right? That's nearly half the border of 1,249 miles. So driving was a problem for me. But the other problem was me putting people in the hospital. And when I called and spoke with Dr. Teresa Long, the flight surgeon out of Fort Rucker, active duty flight surgeon, she had done an affidavit that was eloquent and explained her point of view, what she was seeing with aviators. And so we got together and then we presented to Senator Johnson in the Senate side, Wisconsin Senator, the Defense Medical Epidemiology Database, which showed the skyrocketing, you know, for example, neurologic disorders, 11x rise, you know, 1100%. Okay, so we presented that. And when we did, the DOD shut the system down. And yes, that's when I knew we had a nefarious actor in our midst, either that or a bunch of idiots running the system.
So now, since then, of course, Attorney Thomas Renz has worked with DOD whistleblowers, mm-hmm. you know, other than yourself as well. And a lot of has come out. And yet the Pentagon has not changed its stance. It's, I mean, to my understanding, it's still you have to take the shots, you know, shutting down all critical questioning, shutting down any surgeons or doctors. You know, I've interviewed Dr. Sam Sigaloff as well on this issue. Why, in your estimation, has the Pentagon not been willing to listen to the data on this?
Okay, so yeah, this is Sam Sigaloff is a hero in my book. And, you know, so is Lieutenant Bashaw and Therese Long, obviously the Joan of Arc of this thing. She kicked it off. Why are they tripling down now? It's either pride or it is there are some backside financial reward for people up at the top. And I could not say that when I was in uniform, but the more and more that I see it and more that I understand how this system works, despite the fact that we found out. And look, I testified, Teresa Long testified in Tampa, SEALs versus Lloyd Austin, and we got it admitted into evidence. They were not safe. They are not effective. And how did you, Dr. Chambers, on the border, keep your guys on the border before they were mandated at a very low vax rate, healthy? By lesser intrusive means. This is how simple it is. Betadine mixed with saline. Do a nasal swab after you see 17,000 people this week on the border. Okay, yeah. Doc. And that's what we did, and nobody was sick. Once the mandates came, 77% double vaxxed, the ones that were sick.
So, well, let me ask you this, and you know, you're, of course, never... I'm not trying to push you in any direction on answering this. You're free to disagree, obviously. But I have said, based on interviewing other guests, that it looks to me like there are traitors at the top of the Pentagon that are trying to weaken the U.S. military to make our country vulnerable to invasion or war. Now, I realize that that's pretty far down the spectrum of possibilities. It's pretty damn evil if true. Mm-hmm. What's your reaction to someone like me saying something like that?
I have no problem with that because that's definitely in the quiver of, you know, when you look at when I consider what an enemy is going to do to me, I look at the most likely course of action and the most dangerous, and that's on the most dangerous side. And I have some assurance that is partially true with some of the actors at the top. Yes, that there is sabotage going on of our military. There is a culling of the force of people like me, critical thinkers that say, hey, no, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to interpose. I told his two-star general, no, sir, that's an unlawful order when he told me not to do informed consents. You got to stand up and do that. And when you do that, it's dangerous for you. Despite Whistleblower Act and all these things, it's not worth the paper it's written on. But there are people like those whistleblowers that are out there doing it every day. We got 9 more that just came out with something great and wrote it up and sent it out to every single legislator on the Hill. What is that going to do? It's been served, you know, you've been served kind of thing. But yeah, there are nefarious actors that are within our ranks. I believe that.
Well, that's no surprise to our listeners because, well, there's been a lot of infiltration of many institutions. But let me bring in this other element here. Mm-hmm. In news recently, and this is in the context of escalation into global war, mm-hmm. and the readiness of the United States, or I should say the lack of readiness. So recently it was reported that the United States funded the purchase of 100,000 rounds of artillery from South Korea to be shipped to Ukraine. And I think those are rounds for the M777s, or not the HIMARS rounds, but these, it dawned upon people in reporting that news and reading it that the United States has apparently run out of excess munitions, or is perhaps keeping some amount in reserve, but cannot let go of any more, and is having to reach internationally for munitions to supply Ukraine, which, when that is combined with what we just talked about, the potentially, you know, deliberate weakening of U.S. troops, and then the lack of munitions remaining because so much has been sent to Ukraine, doesn't this raise a lot of red flags about the vulnerability of domestic defense in the U.S.?
Correct. Yeah. At the strategic level, we cannot handle a war on two fronts anymore. And you know, my job as a lieutenant colonel was to marry up the tactical situation on the ground with strategic level planning. And so, you know, those things would come down to me. I know for a fact, and this is me, firsthand information, state of Texas, that our munitions have been depleted, period. Now, I can give you that firsthand. I've heard from other people that, yes, that's happened branch-wide as far as the HIMARS, the Carl Gustavs, which are anti-tank round, been around for a long time. There are newer versions out that are pretty accurate. The 155 rounds, which are howitzer rounds that are, you know, indirect fire weapons. So those have been depleted to the point where, yes, when you're having to shift from other allies or buy, that's pretty sad.
Yeah, I would say. And then you add on top of that the industrial capacity needed to manufacture those weapons and the requirement of resources of things like copper, metal alloys, you know, aluminum, and also energy and transportation and all these things, plus a lot of issues we have with the domestic labor supply, where a lot of people aren't interested in working, frankly. The question becomes, how do we replace those munitions? And if we escalate into a global theater of war, do we even have the capacity to sustain the soldiers in the field, right? That's a legitimate question, is it not?
It's absolutely. Yeah. Logistics, you know, there was once said that an army, you know, marches on its belly. Logistics to be able to bring things to the fight is paramount. You can do small, sustained, limited warfare operations where you jump some guys in behind enemy lines, but eventually they're going to need a resupply.
Right.
And when you can't provide that resupply, this is a, you know, a guy like me, a paratrooper's nightmare.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is like a bridge too far right here. You get dropped in and then you're like, well, good luck, you know?
Good luck, right.
Yeah, I mean, eventually you run out of ammo, especially if you're a paratrooper.
Right, so this is the perfect storm for a setup for us. You know, we had 5 million some odd people come across that border. While I was down there, we had 2 million come across in that short period of time that I was down. 22% that my troops that we evaluated, 22% of those people that came across were fighting age males that were not here with family units. Where are they? That's my concern. Where are they?
Yeah, so this almost brings up a bigger question. I mean, it's like they're putting boots on the ground, occupying the United States with people who could be later activated.
One answer for that, 10th Amendment. Why are we not declaring invasions on the border and in limited, you know, because states have the right to do that in our Constitution. But I feel like every time that we allow our government to declare some sort of emergency, that suspends portions of our Constitution, if not the whole thing. This is a concern. This is why I'm on the legislative, you know, fight now, because I'm speaking directly to these people that are up on the Hill, but also state legislators, to get them to say, hey, this is an invasion on your border. Let's start going after them.
Let's connect the dots then on what we've discussed so far. So on one hand, domestically, we have a Pentagon that is maiming or injuring or killing U.S. Active duty members with vaccines. And to some extent, the civilian population is also being injured or killed by vaccines. And then we have these replacement masses by the millions coming across the border with, frankly, unknown vaccination status. So it's not, my understanding is not being mandated on those coming in. So they will maintain fertility. They will be able to reproduce. But the American people are being killed or made infertile or having spontaneous abortions. I mean, this seems like a straight up genocide operation to me.
This is what, you know, a good friend of mine that you've talked to, Michael Yon, he'll be coming back here soon. Michael has termed the phrase human osmotic pressure. And it is a technique that is used by, you know, Stalin used it into Ukraine way back when, and when they had the famines before there. And that's another story. And when you see that, when you transfer migration, you change the populace, you change the attitudes, you change the national pride, if you will, in some nations. So there is no loyalty to that nation. And that changes so quick. You know, this is a quick flip-flop of ideology, if you will. And that is a Marxist agenda.
And this agenda is also being run against Europe, of course, because we've seen the overrunning of France and Germany and to some extent the UK and other countries there with, I guess you could call them migrants in a polite way, who are coming in and like literally raping the French people. And, you know, it's happening to Western nations. That's the point.
Yes. You know, here's an interesting, to put it in perspective, I was standing on the border one night. We had about 900 people coming across one night in Roma, Texas. And I was standing next to an E7, a sergeant first class. And he looked at me and said, "Doc, you know, when I was 3 years old, I came across that border." And I had been talking to this guy for a while. He's been in two combat deployments, has a Silver Star, a Bronze Star, and a Purple Heart. All right. Kid came across the border illegally, but became a productive member of society. During the typical, and that was 20 years ago or so, probably about 30 years ago when he came across and became a war hero in my book. And now he's telling me that this is unsustainable. Yeah, I feel for these people too. You see the little kids coming across. I saw many. I mean, I've coded some that died of heat, you know, injuries. Sure. But, you know, we love humanity and we love people. But when you can't sustain it in a hospital, we call that a mass cal. You know, when it overwhelms your system and you have to go to triage and working out of bags, it overwhelms your system. You just can't, you got to, if we're going to do this, let's do it right. Let's do it legally. But if they do come across like that, we can handle it. We could have handled it back in the day. But right now it's overwhelming. There was a 24-hour period. We had 17,000 Haitians show up in Del Rio. What do you do with that when you got 50 National Guard guys?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and the other thing is somebody is encouraging all these people to come across and to bring their children for the pity factor. So it's not like these people are spontaneously just coming up with their own idea. Hey, let's go to America. No. You know, someone is marketing this idea to them and even transporting them in many cases to bring them to this point. So they are being exploited by those globalist forces.
That is the human osmotic pressure thing. I mean, that they are pawns in this and like I said, you know, I feel bad for him. I was used as a pawn. We were all used as pawns in certain portions of this Afghanistan debacle, which is a whole nother story.
Right.
But, you know, I feel for those people. I feel for the guys that I lost and their families. Yeah. It's discouraging.
Well, yeah, I feel for them too. And I always believe that the best way to have compassion for humanity is to spread freedom, right? I mean, that's how you end human suffering is allow people to achieve freedom everywhere around the world. And then they don't feel like they have to flee if they feel free and abundant at home, wherever they are. So let's shift gears though to Ukraine. There seems to be kind of a pause in the situation there. There's been apparently a retreat by Russia from Kherson and the weather's getting colder. The ground's not yet fully frozen, but that day is coming. We all know the implications of that from studying World War II and, you know, Soviet movements and so on. Where do you think things stand there right now?
I think we're probably going to see some sort of a negotiation take place. Now, you know, some of this, if we see, should we just stand back and we just think about this in the form of a chess player, if you will, and there are people that are And I'm going to use the globalist elites who are playing chess with different world governments and different black and white checkers on the board. This has been orchestrated for this time in history to happen, just like many other of these things. You know, the Arab Spring, et cetera. These all take place on a global scale, and somebody has to have some sort of a playbook going out there. But in this case, you know, and I came in under Ronald Reagan. We were practicing with our bayonets and Russian dummies, right? I mean, that, you know, the targets. Right. And so we were trained that the Soviet Union is, you know, the demise of the future of the West. But now, you know, you kind of look back and you think, well, if somebody planted a bunch of bioweapons labs on our border at Mexico, wouldn't that concern you? Wouldn't it concern Putin and the Russians and anybody to the north there? It would concern them. And so the enemy of my enemy is my friend in certain times. I've had to you know, partner up with Taliban forces in the past that were not as extreme, because they were getting, you know, plowed by the extremists. And so, you know, sometimes you have to make a loose affiliation with these. But right now, our populace is so sold on, you know, oh, poor Ukraine. And I got it. Anybody in the field that's a civilian that's innocent, I feel bad for them.
Sure.
But these Azov battalion rascals, these dudes come straight in the lineage of the Nazis. All right. That's just a cold, hard fact. You got to study history to know these things. And the Azov battalion has done their share of atrocities as well to false flag, if you will, some of the events that have taken place there. And I'm sure the Russians are no prima donnas here. I mean, they probably have done their share too, but I think they got what they wanted, which was the Donbass region and Lugan. I believe that they're going to hang on to that. I think, you know, they will do a withdrawal. And they'll come to a stalemate, and then I pray that there's some sort of a ceasefire and an agreement. They seem to be reaching out across, you know, diplomatic lines, but I don't know. Give me 2 weeks, and I'll know more.
Well, we do know that countries like Germany are tired of not having energy. That's for sure. Yeah, yeah. And the winter isn't even really here yet, so, you know, wait till January to see what kind of pressure that puts on them. But
right.
It seems to me that the Biden regime has always wanted a strong escalation, or at least the State Department that has been finagling a lot of this. They really hate Russia. And I'm talking about the Victoria Nulands of the world, mm-hmm. You know, the Blinkens. They hate Russia. They want to destroy Russia. And it also seems like they need a big war globally in order to assert more power domestically, to have another big emergency.
Right.
And also even potentially fiscally, to have another reason to print more money and prop up the markets a little bit longer by creating a global emergency. So what are your thoughts on that?
Right. Yeah. So in chaos ensues, you know, I mean, everything goes to a higher state of entropy, right? I mean, and that's what they seem to thrive on, is just throw more chaos at it, declare more emergencies. Yes, you're absolutely right. You know, the printing with the Fed, printing of money, the fiat currency is basically valueless, truly, if somebody called our marker right now on this thing. And it really sets us up for a fall. And you had some eloquent discussion with Michael Yon on famine.
Yes.
And, you know, and I started reading more books on it, because Michael was like, read this, read this. I got like six more books I'm going through. But but truly, when we look at, we look back at it's almost like this was planned way back in the day. There was this Agricultural Adjustment Act. This is 1938 under Roosevelt and his New Deal. And when they started paying subsidies to farmers to not grow things in the United States, when you thought there was abundance, right? And that whole thing was a facade, and it was based on an emergency. That's their key term, emergency. Anytime you see that, or sustainable development, when you see these key words, these are scary words. Run. Okay. And Now what are they doing with energy? We had a surplus. Now we don't. It's the same thing that they did with the farmers.
Well, where do you think this ends up here under the next 2 years of Biden or Democrat rule? I think a lot of our listeners believe that this election was very aggressively rigged. They they stop the counts, and then they print more ballots, whatever they need to just barely pull out a victory. And so the Democrats, I mean, at this point, they may even take the House. I mean, it's not over yet at this point, but it's all rigged. But where is this going in the next couple of years, in your view?
Right. Okay. So, you know, I have to look at things just like I would if I was in any given country or any given time. And there's three different environments, you know, your atmospherics. I always look at atmospherics, the 40,000 foot view. And right now, you and I, we live, you know, in Central Texas area or in Texas. And, you know, this is a permissive environment, right? Until you get to the border, then it's a semi-permissive environment. It you know, possibly could be controlled by cartels. You go to a country like Jordan sitting next to Syria, that's a semi-permissive environment. You can go down the street of Amman, and I've done it, and it's relatively safe, but you can also run around the corner and there's a car bomb. And then you go to places like Baghdad in 2004, and it's non-permissive. Or the Donbass region is non-permissive. So I have to think of them in those three scales. So where are we now? We're permissive, unless you're on the streets of Portland and Antifa shows up, then it's non-permissive. So think these things can shift. And I think what we're going to see is in some of these big blue cities, we're going to see non-permissive environments that will ensue as people get in a corner. When the diesel runs out and you can't get your supplies to market, you got to think about the second and third order effects of these. So then you roll into a non-permissive or semi-permissive environment, maybe sometimes based upon a street corner here, and a couple blocks later, it's non-permissive. Mm-hmm. So you got to think of your lines of effort or your PACE plan, your primary alternate contingency emergency plans for each individual type environment. Where are we going to be in a couple years? I think we'll have pockets of free zones in America, and this is what I'm working on with groups doing neighborhood watch programs, free zones. And then you'll have places like that that will be semi to non-permissive, and there will be civil war, so to speak. And it may not be the blue versus the gray, but the desperate and the downtrodden being, you know, attacked, oppressed by those nefarious actors that I call brown shirts, you know, those Antifas or BLMs, those types.
Wow. So you're talking about these operations becoming very, very localized. The granularity of it could be quite small.
That is, you know, once again, going on that scale of most likely course of action to most dangerous, that's the most likely. Most dangerous course of action, somebody shuts off a power grid this winter in Texas and, you know, nobody can get anything anywhere, and makes it look like an EMP. You know, you can do that. We've played that scenario. We've done that red cell on that, so to speak. Even in the military, we've looked at it, and not to do it, but to respond to it in the Texas military. So we have to consider those things. That's the most dangerous side of it. But I still think, you know, the most likely is going to be those sporadic outlying bad areas, and then the free zones, of which we're going to be trading and continuing life and creating our own parallel universe, because we're going to have to. It's what we did in the old days.
Well, but also a factor in this is that anytime it seems that a left-wing group commits violence domestically, even against civilians, they're going to be, you know, just let out of jail by the DAs. Whereas if any kind of a conservative group even dares to bear arms, just showing up in and just kitted out or whatever, you know, not even bearing the arms, just everything's holstered, they're going to be considered to be extremists and terrorists. And so it's almost as if self-defense is being criminalized in this country.
Right. Yeah. You know, and it, once again, it depends on where you're at. I went to dinner tonight, and, you know, I'm in a north central Texas town, and there was probably five people with open carries sitting around me eating, and everybody was having a good time. Lots of respect going on.
Right.
And, yeah, that's where I'm at. You know, I kept mine concealed, but still, that's just this community. So I, you know, I wouldn't try to do that in D.C. You know, first of all, it's illegal. But, you know, but yeah, that, and it's interesting how, you know, the worst cities in the country with regard to firearms, murders, and, I mean, stabbings for that matter. I mean, let's outlaw knives. are some of these blue cities that have the most stringent laws. You know, I worked in DC for a while. You get up in Northeast DC and you can get shanked pretty quick.
Oh yeah, no kidding. But exploring this topic a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So as the infrastructure failures kick in, food scarcity, grocery deliveries don't take place, diesel shortages, a breakdown of the rule of law, it's going to be exacerbated in these blue cities where there's been defunding of police and also where criminals have been let loose and back onto the streets repeatedly by these George Soros DAs. So you're going to have, it seems to me, a lot of innocent but left-leaning civilians who find themselves in just a hell zone of crime that they did not anticipate would happen when they voted Democrat. But they're usually anti-gun people too, so they're going to be completely, you know, defenseless. And I'm not mocking them. I feel sorry for them, but that's the reality, isn't it?
Right. That is the reality. That's the innocence in all of this. And, you know, gosh, we've seen it all around the world, and it's heartbreaking at times, but, you know, it's just a fact of, I don't know if you want to call it armed combat or combat, but a different form of warfare. And this is fifth generation warfare, and it's so driven by media and so driven by digital, you know, influences. And then you throw in that lower level type warfare in the midst, and it becomes so chaotic, and people don't know what to do because they're watching their local news station. And I tell you, you know, turn on a news station from Chicago sometime and watch what they're reporting on the ground there. And it's sometimes I do that just to see what their people are being told. And that's a disinformation campaign.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about local solutions, though. So what can people do locally to organize in a way that is defensive and humanitarian and not, you know, not like a vigilante group type of thing?
Right. Right. Oh, this is my forte. I was the perfect guy for this situation at the time, just because of the experiences as a doc and having that humanitarian, you know, my dad was a small town doctor, used to do house calls and drive around with me, and I'd carry his bag. So I know what it's like to drive around and care for people and trade out for services. And that's kind of what, you know, I'm looking at will end up happening. But first of all, you know, a lot of this sounds like doom and gloom, and people listening, you know, I always get at the end, what can we do? And I tell you what you can do. There's a rule of chaos that, you know, when you want to control it, you can't control it. And so you control the controllables. If you're a pilot, or if you jump out of planes for a living like me, when you have an emergency procedure or you have an emergency, you go to an emergency procedure and you control the controllables. I've been spinning through the air, tumbling through the air at night with a, you know, 115 pound ruck on with a chute malfunction, and pulled out of it, and thank the Lord, was able to land it because of my training and experience of doing it, and say, hey, control the first thing and then the second thing. So that's number one. The other thing is that, you know, I have a military working dog. His name is Joe. And this guy is the most high speed creature on the planet when it comes to looking for work. And we call it look for work. So look for work. That's part of this, is look for things to do, because it's not just about doing your job, coming home, and then sitting on the couch and then not shoring up your foxhole, so to speak. You've got to shore up your own stockpiles. You've got to meet your neighbors. You got to go out and start talking to people. And then when you start talking to people, you find people of like mind, and this is what I do, it's called networking, and you say, hey, let's go and start a neighborhood watch program. This is legal. You go to your sheriff and you say, or police department, and you register as a neighborhood watch program. And this is what we've done now in a few different Texas regions and into Oklahoma and into the nations with the Indian tribes. And people get together based upon their skill sets. We're not talking about, you know, everybody's got to have a gun and let's go out and practice on the range, because that's not what this is about. Because this will come in handy way sooner for the next hurricane, the next snowstorm, next tornado in Tornado Alley up in the panhandle. You know, this town may have to go and react to that town. That's where I grew up, and that's what you do. When the tornado squashes your neighbor's town, you go over there and you help them. But you can't do it if you're not organized. And that's why I say get organized, because these humanitarian things are going to be 90% of what you do. And God forbid that somebody shows up in your neighborhood and wants to take advantage or to oppress your neighbors and start run amok, if you will. then at that point, you're going to have to assist law enforcement because you may become your own 911.
Sure.
And that's where training comes in and those kind of things. But not everybody can do that. But everybody can do something on the humanitarian side and help network these things. Be a lookout.
What I love about the Neighborhood Watch Program concept, and I'm really glad you're pursuing this, is number one, you can distribute radio equipment and get people used to communicating on radios. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like paramilitary or whatever. It's just a backup comms system. If the grid goes down, you know, if the cell towers go down, which happened mm-hmm. in Texas last year, just having radios. And then once you know how to talk to each other on radios and, you know, how to just choose frequencies and radio mm-hmm. etiquette and so on, and understanding ranges and power levels of transmission power and so on, you can layer in other types of responses on top of that infrastructure.
Oh, yes. I'm going back to a meeting Thursday night down in Central Texas, a little further south, to one that was started down there. And I had to leave. And so somebody else took the reins. And luckily, two Green Berets are on that Neighborhood Watch program, retired guys. And Michael Yon is going to be down there helping us out. But they have meetings, you know, once every other week. And they have a comms guy that comes in, and he knows about ham radios. He knows about this. So you think about him as like your central command, if you will, of communications out to the networks. And he has a repeater. And so he can link people up, and he's helping them out of the goodness of his heart to do this stuff. He's a retired Air Force guy. And so you see this network, and then you got these little old ladies who can't do much, but they show up to these meetings. You got an 85-year-old lady. Last time I was talking to her down there in at this meeting. And she's like, well, I can bring preserves. Okay. Yeah. Sounds good.
Everybody's got to eat, you know?
Right.
Right.
I love it.
That's right. Everybody can contribute in one way or another. And by the way, you know, you give her like a thermal night vision monocular and she can look through it, you know?
That's right. Well, and the thing is, you know, that she exists too. And this is the beautiful thing about neighborhoods is some people live in neighborhoods their whole lives and don't even know who's down the street. But when you do, and something happens, like we had that big winter storm. I mean, I was, you know, in the National Guard, so I was driving around responding and doing house calls. But you know, people would say, hey, there's this old lady who lives down the road. Can you go check on her? Absolutely. I mean, that's what you do. This is, you know, this is love. I mean, that's what you do. You love your others like you'd love yourself. This is a mandate. And I've always said, look, 39 years of wearing a uniform, I always search for what's the truest virtue of a warrior. And I thought when I was a young paratrooper, oh, it's about sticking people in the belly with a bayonet. No, no, it ain't about that. It's about getting medals. No, it ain't about that. You know what it's about? It's about love. It's about love for your fellow soldiers and the people behind you that you're protecting. And you don't operate out of hate, you know, with the enemy. That's taking care of business. That's a different thing. But I'm talking about love. And it took me a while to figure that one out, but it's great when you operate in that maturity level or that tactical maturity level.
Well, big picture question for you then on all of this.
Mm-hmm.
What's your sense of America making it through these challenges? And we've covered quite a few of them here, and we may mm-hmm. possibly be in a war. We may be invaded. There might be an invasion happening right now. Do you have faith that the American spirit, the American philosophy, the American people are mm-hmm. resilient enough to make it through this?
There's a saying from 480 BC, and a Spartan said it about his fellow Spartans. Out of 100 soldiers, 10 shouldn't even be here. 80 are nothing but targets, and 9 they the battle make. And the one is a leader, and he'll lead the others back. Those numbers haven't changed for me, at least from 1983 on. We still have those in the ranks of the military. If something were to happen to the United States where we were attacked, and it truly was a real invasion of our country, God help us. You know, there's just not enough people that are enlightened enough to see what's going on around them, because they're so caught up in less than a meter in front of their face, the phone that sits in front of them, yeah. And so caught up in what is Oprah going to say and The View going to say, so caught up in such trivial things. And I got it. I'm an ultra alpha, and my job is to protect. I'm a sheepdog. So I might not think like them, but but you got to have a little bit of that. You got to have a little bit. And if you don't, I just, God help them. And I hope there's enough of us out there that can.
Well, I feel like I need to push you to answer the question a little in a little more detail on this.
Yeah.
I hope you don't mind me saying, but can America, do we have enough of those good people to overcome and then to restore or to refound America? Because I think a lot of our listeners believe that America has been lost, especially with the rigged elections and, you know, the coming collapse of the dollar and so on. But the culture too, the culture has become so demonic in many ways. And there's open acceptance of genital mutilation of children, and pedophilia and all this. It's, you know, a lot of people feel hopeless, but then you talk to really great people and that American spirit is not lost at all.
Right. Straight up. Yeah. Straight up Pete Chambers from my heart. I know that the communities that I talk to will have a higher chance of survival, and that listen and that train, and that not only train, you know, when I say train, don't, because I'm a Green Beret or whatever, don't think that I mean anything about being offensive to any. What I'm talking about is trained to survive. What I'm talking about is trained to be a good neighbor. Those areas have a higher chance. There are some areas in this country though that will have no chance whatsoever. And I've spent time in those cities, and it will just, I saw what happened because I saw what happened. I saw what happened in the border of Syria and Jordan when 70,000 refugees showed up at a refugee camp. I saw how people turned on each other. And I saw at Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans as a soldier there responding to it, what people did in those communities in a hurricane. And they knew there was an end to this. It was a temporal thing. But what concerns me is humanity, when you've been subjected to the dark side that has been over our nation for so long. You know, I could get real scriptural and real biblical here, but I'm going to stay off a lot of that. But I'm a believer, and I believe that we need to take a knee. We need to, you know, repent, but that's just not happening quick enough. And I just pray that that there's some and I know there is mercy, but that on our nation, as a nation, that we survive this, because there will be pockets that do. But I know for a fact in those big cities, and I hope this is clear enough to you, that they won't.
So you, if I could paraphrase, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're observing a set of conditions that exist in many of these blue cities that are only sort of one tipping point away from devolving or collapsing into some of the worst case scenarios that you've observed in overseas scenarios?
Overseas and stateside, you know, in different places. But I saw other places along the border down to Mississippi, all the way from Louisiana, that communities came together. So you I don't know what it is. It's, there's a certain feeling when you walk into certain places of the brotherly love that's there or not. And that's, I know that's kind of a, you know, huggy feely, kind of touchy feely phrase, but it's just, there's just a certain feeling that I can sense that there's not a lot of love there. And when you see that, you think, what's going to happen when you add the ingredient of chaos to it? And that ingredient does some weird things to people.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. I mean, think about after Hurricane Katrina, then we saw New Orleans very quickly devolve into, well, that people, you know, looting and even in some cases killing or violently attacking each other.
Yeah, chaos.
Real chaos. I mean, people, dead bodies floating down the streams. People abandoned because they were in a wheelchair or they had a medical need, like diabetics couldn't get insulin and so on. I mean, it was, and that those were the same people that the week before you might have met in the line at the grocery store, and they would have been perfectly polite.
Right. Yeah. I, you know, I don't know. So that's what I feel, you know, and it really depends on who it is that's attacking us, because right now there are no uniforms involved. We are under attack. Don't think we're not. We are under attack currently. It's just there's no visible uniforms.
Yes.
And the actors are not armies, but evil narcissists that are using their political and financial wherewithal in the wrong way. And they'll have to, you know, stand judgment for that. You know, But God, I pray we can turn this around. But I think before people get enlightened or wake up, and I don't talk about wokeism, but I talk about waking up or being enlightened to find true discernment, it's got to get harder before it happens.
Yeah, seems so. Mm-hmm. Now, let me just ask you as we're wrapping this up, if people go to your website, drpetechambers.com, so drpetechambers.com, and that you've got links to Telegram and other things, what if people follow you, what are they going to receive from you? What's your focus day to day?
So my focus with that website, the only reason I created it was so that when I'm out on the road, because I'm literally on the road just about every other day driving, you know, me and my dog to go meet with people. What I had, it was a repository for information so that if it's a line of effort that aligns with something you're interested in, you can go to that site, go to my lines of effort, and you can see, is this about famine? Is this about 5G? Is this about, you know, the shots? Is this about radiation exposure? Is this about legislation, informed consent? All the things that I've done in my last part of my career, really, it's all kind of come together, and I put it there so people could look at it and I could talk to them. But then you can also network with me, and you can get on there and get on, you know, send me an email. It takes me a little while to catch up with them all. But I do answer them, and I want to be able to network with people of like mind so that we can find those communities out there that are needing that help, or I can put them in contact with other networks just like me. They're not all military people. You don't have to be a military person. I mean, you know, look at yourself. You've done some amazing things for communities around the world, I'd say. And it doesn't require any day in uniform. What it requires is the right heart and the right mind and training. So yeah, that's it. It's just, that's the place for me to communicate and to share, and then, hopefully meet some folks along the way that are like-minded, and we can do what we call, force multiply. Yes. And when you force multiply, that's what we do. That's what makes us so effective.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. I really love your approach and your philosophy, and I'll share with you when I was in high school trying to figure out, you know, whether to go to college or what to do. I did take a series of tests with the United States Marine Corps, and they invited me to join the officer training school with the U.S. Mm-hmm. Marines, but I decided to take some scholarships and go to university instead. But they wanted me in the officer school, so who knows? In a different universe, I could have gone that way.
Yeah, you know, We all end up where we're at, and people say, you know, stuff like to me all the time. I'm like, look, God put you where you are for a reason. I mean, I didn't plan on being in for 39 years total with all the, you know, active guard reserve, but 9/11 happened. I came back, and there you go. I mean, I'm still going because I love the people that I work with, and every one of them is like family to me. And now what they're doing is just, it's killing me. It's breaking my heart, but I've got to continue the fight. That's why I'm still doing, you know, fact witness work in different court cases and things like that so that I can help.
Yeah.
And I don't take a dime for it. I don't, you know, people think, oh, you got to be making all kinds of money. I'm like, bro, you have no idea.
Yeah.
I'm exactly. Selling cattle so that I can put some diesel in this because it's $5 a gallon in some places.
Yeah, exactly. No, I know exactly what you're talking about. And we appreciate you. And, you know, I just want to say God bless you on behalf of our audience and for all the work that you do. And There are many things we didn't have time to get into, but you're working behind the scenes in a lot of ways that I'm aware of that are really profound. So thank you for all that you're doing.
Yes, sir. You're worth it.
Well, you know, humanity, we're all in this fight for humanity, and that's what matters in the end. And just to work in alignment with God in any way that we possibly can. So I just want to say thank you. And just want to invite the audience to visit your website, drpetechambers.com. That's drpetechambers.com. And Doc, it's an honor to know you, an honor to be able to visit with you here. And I hope that we get a chance to do this again soon.
I'm sure we will.
All right. Well, thank you so much. God bless you.
Take care, sir.
You too. Now, just stand by for a minute. For those listening, just want to say thank you. And feel free to repost this interview as usual on your own channels or other platforms. And thank you for tuning in. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon.com, the platform I built so that we can have interviews just like this. So thank you for listening. God bless you all. Take care.
A global reset is coming.
And that's why I've recorded a new 9-hour audiobook. It's called The Global Reset Survival Guide. You can download it for free by subscribing to the naturalnews.com email newsletter, which is also free. I'll describe how the monetary system fails. I also cover emergency medicine and first aid and what to buy to help you avoid infections. So download this guide. It's free. It's my gift to you simply because I want like-minded people to survive.